Welcome to this week's edition of Far West Texas. Readings from the Big Bend Sentinel, the Monahans News, and the Fort Stockton Pioneer, read by volunteers and staff. You can hear this program on Recording Library of West Texas Radio and on demand at recordinglibrary.org.
This is Melanie, and I'm reading the Big Bend Sentinel, published July 15, 2020. Frustrated by state efforts, Marfa wants its own contact tracing, by Stephen Paulson, July 15, 2020. Marfa. Michael Roque wondered if he had coronavirus. He knew people who tested at the same time at the same Marfa testing site in June, and they all got results within 3 days, but he was still waiting. But when a worker with Texas Department of State Health Services called Roque the next day with his positive results, it was still a shock. "I was a little discombobulated," he said. His mind raced to anyone he might have interacted with while contagious. "Who have I seen?" he asked himself. "What have I done?" Thankfully, Roque had been mostly staying put. So when state officials asked him about his recent possible contacts, he didn't have too many to list. He told the state health worker that he'd worked at the Marfa Volunteer Fire Department and that he'd responded to an incident a couple of days earlier. "In firefighting, social distancing is something we cannot do," Roque said in an interview Monday. "It doesn't work with one person. We're often in close quarters." He gave the official contact information for his boss, Jenny Moore, at the Chinati Foundation, where Roque is the Director of Education and Curricula. He might have also mentioned that he visited a local restaurant, but isn't sure. Then the call was over. Roque wondered whether he forgot to mention any contacts. "I think it could have been done maybe a little bit slower or spelled out a little bit better," Roque said. But he knew the official was busy. They have to go through all these phone calls. As coronavirus case counts climb across Texas, it has overwhelmed state efforts to contain and trace the virus. The Big Bend Sentinel reported on these issues last month, noting the regional contact tracers tasked with the Tri-County also covered 33 other counties, including big cities and nursing homes with outbreaks. Testing, distributing results, and now contact tracing have overwhelmed the state. "They're inundated," Presidio County Judge Cinderella Guevara said at a county meeting last Wednesday, addressing delays in testing results and other issues. In Roque's case, contact tracing went more or less how it should. Roque told the interviewer about his contacts at the Marfa Volunteer Fire Department. State officials called Fire Chief Jerry Mitschke a day later, telling him that staff could have contacts. Mitschke went into quarantine and told around five other firefighters to do the same. But like so much of the state's response to coronavirus, the experience hasn't been consistent for everybody. With testing, some people get results in days, while others wait for weeks. Likewise, while Roque described his DSHS interview as confident and thorough, not everyone has his experience. Doctors and officials across the region have heard reports of people who weren't adequately traced, or worse, were never contacted at all. On social media, residents have complained about never hearing results, positive or negative, from state health officials. And in at least one case, one person later found out they were positive. After enlisting the help of a local doctor to get her results, Laurie Quigg, an Alpine resident, learned she had coronavirus. "By the time the doctor actually made the call to me," Quigg said, "I was experiencing symptoms. She was so exhausted with nausea and headaches." Another Tri-County resident, who wished to remain anonymous about his positive coronavirus status, was somewhere in between those two extremes. State officials at first did a lot of contact tracing, a family member said, reaching out to everyone that patient remembered interacting with. But when that patient thought of some more contacts, the experience was different. State officials did not contact those people, according to his relative. Even in Roque's case, details were overlooked. Jenny Moore, executive director at the Chinati Foundation, said in an email that she'd never been contacted by state health workers. Roque said he'd been with Moore during his infection window, though they were standing apart and wearing masks. "Maybe that's why they didn't contact her," he said. "I have no idea." Mark Scott, co-owner at Convenience West, where Roque had picked up a meal during his potential infection window last month, also said he didn't think the restaurant ever heard from contact investigators. And it was Roque, not health workers, who told Convenience West about the contact, prompting the restaurant to close for 2 weeks as a precaution. These mixed experiences have been troubling for people like Don Culberson, a physician assistant at the Marfa Clinic. Decades ago, he worked as a contact tracer in King County, in Washington State, where he focused on sexually transmitted diseases. It was like being an investigator cop, he said of those days. We drove around looking for leads. He would go to bars and ask workers if they'd seen someone matching a particular description. Culberson said Culberson would like to see efforts similar in this case. I think COVID is a particularly amenable to contact tracing, he said. Unlike diseases like HIV, AIDS, coronavirus has an incubation period of days, not months. But from talking to patients and officials, Culberson didn't see much gumshoe work like this happening in the Tri-County. He puts the blame on anemic funding for health resources in Texas. If it doesn't have to do with oil or pipelines, we're not funded very well, he said, but now we have a pandemic. Faced with reports like this, officials in Marfa have started to wonder if they could do better. After months of considering the idea, and with case counts continuing to climb in the state region, city leaders this week hoped to discuss setting up local contact tracing efforts at a city council meeting on Tuesday. But with no sign-off from the state, and with state officials telling county officials that local efforts like this wouldn't be legal, the item didn't make it onto the agenda. In the meantime, some officials are starting to lose patience. The city of Marfa isn't the only tri-county government wondering if it could set up its own contact tracing efforts. At a meeting about coronavirus last week, Alpine city leaders said they would definitely segment off resources to help with contact tracing. According to city manager Eric Zimmer, who was present at the meeting, they asked Dr. Escobar to look into it. But in an interview on Monday, Zimmer said that, last he'd heard, there was still no answer from the state. Dr. Escobar did not respond to requests for comment. Would it be legal for Marfa to set up its own contact tracing efforts? Asked about these issues, a DSHS spokesperson did not respond directly about Marfa's situation or the legal ins and outs. Instead, she noted that cities with health departments, which typically included both metro areas like Midland and Houston, and not small towns like Marfa, were largely handling their own contact tracing. Cities without their own health departments could use regional investigators, she said, and in both cases, information from local or regional tracing efforts was uploaded into the statewide Texas Health Trace system, which also has a call center to pick up additional loads. Most local health departments chose to continue doing their own case investigations and contact tracing, the spokesperson added. The call center is set up to accommodate additional case investigations. Meanwhile, the city of Marfa and Presidio County have themselves at odds over this issue. The county says Marfa can't set up its own contact tracing. Gary Mitch, the emergency management coordinator for Presidio County, cited the legal and logistical issues of getting confidential state health data to city or county workers, as well as the ethical problems of having Marfa's contact tracing friends and neighbors. Presidio County Judge Cinderella Guevara, who has spent days researching the issue with health officials, agrees that local efforts wouldn't be legal. Instead, she says, any locals who wanted to help with local contact tracing would instead need to work under the daily oversight of DSHS. But it would be DSHS's decision on whether or not to scale up those efforts. And even if the state did hire some Marfans, they would likely be working not just locally, but making tracing calls all across the state. I applaud the efforts of those in our community eager to volunteer to help stop the spread of COVID-19 by becoming contact tracers for our area, Judge Guevara wrote in an email, citing conversations with state officials. However, the state does not currently allow for this. When locals have tried to become contact tracers, though, they haven't had much luck. At a Presidio County Commissioner's Court meeting last week, one resident complained that she'd been trying unsuccessfully to become a contact tracer. But after applying to around 8 jobs, mostly in Texas but also elsewhere, she kept hitting these weird roadblocks, she said later. Among them was a job that required her to have a PC. She didn't. And another that required her to be a furloughed employee in the state of Virginia. She wasn't. She'd started looking outside of Texas after running into dead ends in the state. City leaders aren't so sure they can't do contact tracing, because while Judge Guevara is hearing one thing from the state, some local leaders say they're hearing otherwise. Take Buck Johnson, a Marfa City Council member who has spearheaded efforts to bring contact tracing down to the local level. Her goal, she says, is to create one or two new contact investigator positions in the city, with Culbertson likely taking on one of them. But with the conversations on the topic lagging since March, she's growing frustrated with what she called bureaucratic slowness. "I just feel like it's worth a try," Johnston said of those efforts. "It would be a real game changer for us." There are a few reasons why Johnston thinks Marfa could set up its own contact tracers. For one thing, the Texas Department of Emergency Management says cities can use CARES, Coronavirus Aid, Relief, and Economic Security Act funding to establish such a program. A New York Times article last week noted that Corpus Christi has dozens of contact tracers. Unfortunately, the situation isn't exactly parallel with Marfa's. Nueces County, where Corpus Christi is, has its own health department, where the Tri-County relies on Region 910 of DSHS due to the absence of local health departments. Another piece of evidence Marfa could have its own tracing, Johnson says, is that a member of Governor Abbott's task force told her as much. In a lengthy email which Johnston shared with the Big Bend Sentinel, Dr. John Carlo, a Dallas-based doctor and member of the task force, told her he could find no legal basis for barring Marfa from establishing such a program. "I don't know how they could not allow the city of Marfa to conduct the same activity as Dallas, Houston, and San Antonio, which are all doing their own contact tracing investigations," he said. "The issue would be whether or not your local jurisdiction has a sworn health authority." Presidio County does, in fact, have a sworn health authority, Dr. John Paul Schwartz. And like Johnston, he's losing patience with the red tape. "Out here in West Texas, we're way behind in terms of contact tracing," he said in an interview on Monday. "I haven't seen any agents on the ground out here. I see contact tracing all being done over the phone, which is the least effective way you can do it. There's no leadership from the country, and there's no leadership from the state government," he added. "It's total incompetence from the top to the bottom." Another issue, Dr. Schwartz says, is that while the Tri-County is effectively one big community, formal distinctions between the counties prevent health officials from sharing data with each other in a timely manner. "We're a triple county region," he said. "It works all as one unit, and the state should be turning into the single health zone and treating it like that." Roque, the Marfa patient, has had positive experiences with the DSHS. The person I had really cared, he said of his contact investigator, noting that they called him every few days to check in. They sometimes even chatted about a shared interest, Marfa. Instead, Roque thinks DSHS isn't getting the resources it needs from the state. "For being under budgeted," he added, "they do a lot." Still, Roque said, contact tracing seemed to be the missing link. And when his experiences were over, he wrote a letter to his caseworker, thanking DSHS for their patience with him and encouraging some changes to make the contact tracing experience more user-friendly. Among his suggestions, give people simple prompts and encourage them to make a two-week calendar of any possible contacts. "I doubt I'm the only person with an, oh yeah, I forgot moment," he wrote. He also suggested that patients be given the option to share protected information with local officials. Marfa Solidarity Bonds raise over $85,000 for local restaurants. By Stephen Paulson, July 15, 2020. Marfa. The final numbers are in for the Marfa Solidarity Bonds project, and pretty much everyone involved is walking away happy. The initiative, which saw people buying artist-designed bonds to support local restaurants, was arguably a win-win. Artists got new outlets for the work, locals got to take home some artwork in the form of bonds, and restaurants, reeling from coronavirus, got a helping hand in a time of crisis. In the end, organizers sold more than 2,700 bonds, along with $10,000 in matching donations from the Permian Basin Area Foundation. They raised more than $85,000. To further support the community, restaurants also gave back with an $11,000 gift to the Marfa Food Pantry. "It was all local effort," said Shelley Bernstein, an organizer for the project. Bernstein was living in Red Hook, a hard-to-reach neighborhood of Brooklyn, when Hurricane Sandy hit in 2012. Area businesses needed help. but government aid was too slow, and some didn't qualify, Bernstein said. One business started selling artist-designed junk bonds to stay afloat. As the pandemic ripped across the world, shuttering businesses in Marfa, Bernstein found herself thinking about that initiative. It sounded very similar to our situation today, she said, and she started wondering if a similar effort could help Marfa businesses. Bernstein and others started reaching out to artists. Marfa institutions like the Judd Foundation, the Chinati Foundation, and Ballroom Marfa helped spread word about the project. It didn't take long for artists to come aboard. When local artist J.D. Garcia heard about the project, he quickly agreed to join, designing a bond featuring a mirror image photo manipulation of a windmill. Same with Camp Bosworth, another Marfa artist. Organizers asked if I wanted to participate, and I said I'd love to, he recalled. He designed a bond in the style of a dollar bill, replete with a drawing of Donald Judd, where a president might have been. Emblazoned on the top of inside of an image are the phrases, "In Judd we trust," and "One square meal." Both Bosworth and Garcia were hit by the coronavirus crisis in their own ways. Bosworth co-owns the Wrong Marfa store and gallery with his wife, City Council member Buck Johnston. Like small businesses across the country, they temporarily closed for shutdown orders and have since had to navigate new safety measures. All of us are dealing with a degree of uncertainty, Bosworth said, and that is especially true for friends and neighbors working in the restaurant industry. For every one of those restaurants, you know who owns it and you know who's in the kitchen cooking. We're all social together. It's a tight-knit community. Garcia, meanwhile, was working as a bartender at Lost Horse before the pandemic. But Lost Horse was ordered to close, and Garcia found himself out of that job. Other bartender friends were in the same position. For Garcia, the project was a way to bring the community together when social distancing has torn it apart. The other artists involved in the project, he noted, included not just friends, but artists he admired. It was cool to be there with some really badass artists, like Zoe Leonard and Christopher Wool, Garcia said. It was kind of mind-blowing, contributing to the same thing as these major artists, as well as some of my really good friends. Bosworth and Garcia sent their artwork to organizers. From there, locals chose a bond they wanted, a restaurant they wanted to support, and a bond value ranging from $5 to $100. Organizers have declined to release information on which bonds and restaurants raised the most money. We were mindful a fundraiser like this one should end up being a competition, Bernstein said. Regardless, the initiative proved to be a boon for participating restaurants. Among them was Convenience West, where co-owner Mark Scott said the extra money provided a pretty large feeling of security. It replaced what would have been a few good catering gigs, he said, of the money the restaurant got through the bonds. There was a sigh of relief when we knew money was coming in. In the end, Scott said, Marfa Solidarity Bonds provided Convenience West more help than emergency loans from the federal government. He was extremely, extremely, extremely taken aback by the efforts put in by organizers, from artists who designed the bonds to those who printed and mailed them out. I will be forever grateful, he said of the project. It's incredible. It brings a tear to my eye. The project may turn out to be an even bigger success than organizers planned. Initially, organizers intended the bonds to be essentially coupons worth half their cost, so that, for example, a bond purchased for $50 could later be redeemed for $25 in meals. But talk to bond purchasers, and some of them have no plans of turning over the artwork they bought in support of local restaurants. That could have a doubling effect, providing even more cash to businesses in need. Take Molly Shea, a Marfa resident who purchased several bonds. She described the Solidarity Bonds project in both local and worldwide terms as a creative community response to a global crisis. I have no intention of redeeming the bonds I purchased, Shea said. And while the bonds retailed for half their cost, Shea said she got back so much more than I put in, which is a beautiful thing. I am a sentimental person, Shea added, and I plan on keeping my bonds. As she saw it, buying Solidarity Bonds was more than a way of giving back. She also got a gift from the project with a memento of how Marfa supported its community in this intensely difficult time. Locked Down in Marfa, a Brooklyn Musician Makes Dreaming in the Desert Music, by Abby Perot, July 15th, 2020. Marfa, what does it sound like when the wind in the desert hits your skin? Roberto Lange asked Janann Darrow as she improvised on viola. Lange, often recognized by his stage name Helado Negro, released an EP, Kite Symphony, 4 variations at the end of June, that collages together his spacious instrumentation with familiar West Texas sounds, collected and arranged during Lange's stay in Marfa. Lange and his collaborator, Christy Sword, initially arrived in Marfa for a brief trip in early spring to work on Kite Symphony, a project commissioned by Ballroom Marfa. But through the course of their visit, coronavirus struck home back in Brooklyn. Texas experienced a stay-at-home order, and the artist stumbled into a forced months-long residency in West Texas. As their itineraries changed, so too did the scope of the project, growing far beyond their concept of collecting the sounds of West Texas through their hand-built kites. It soon expanded into a broader, multidimensional work that includes kites, ephemeral sculptures, sound collecting, video, and now an album. The 4-track EP Kite Symphony, 4 variations, offers minimalist, drone, ambient qualities, but also warped jazz and classical sensibilities, Lange described. Sword provided dynamic rhythmic drawings, visual representations of music through symbols outside the world of traditional music notation that became rough scores for Lange to put together his synthesizer explorations of piano tracks. From there, Lange layered in local violinist Dara's loosely directed improvisations, mixed in the collected sounds of the day, and rearranged it all from his home or at Marfa Recording Company, before finally inviting cornetist Rob Misurek's additions and rearranging it all again. It was a constantly evolving sound, Lange said, like clouds passing in front of the sun, creating shapes that shade the landscape for a brief period of time. The arrangements ultimately offer ambient meditations, with Lange's synths and beats eventually giving way to field recordings by Lange and Sword that locals will recognize as the familiar bird calls and cricket chirps that have marked many evening walks and relaxations on the porch during this year's quiet Marfa spring. When Lange explained the broad umbrella of the project in May, he told the Big Bend Sentinel that each piece is dealing with intricacies and nuances of what this landscape is about and dialing that in terms of reactions and impressionistic versions of what we feel, see, and what it's like to experience the feeling of being out here. It's amazing, alien, and wild. The sound pieces are an invitation to experience fleeting, familiar West Texas moments. It's dreaming in the desert music, said Lange. This week, the album garnered a coveted 8.0 review on Pitchfork and became one downloadable perk of joining Ballroom Marfa during their annual membership drive. The songs are available exclusively on Ballroom Marfa's Bandcamp and are accompanied by a video for the album's final track, Suede House, recorded by Sword and Lange in Marfa during March 2020. 25% of proceeds from the Bandcamp purchases will benefit Texas Rio Grande Legal Aid, a nonprofit law firm that provides free legal services to low-income residents. The broader project, Kite Symphony, organized by Ballroom Marfa Programs Director Sarah Melendez, will debut through Ballroom this fall.
Hello, this is Sonia reading the Fort Stockton Pioneer for Thursday, July 23rd, 2020. Mask wearing now mandatory in Pecos County by Steve Fountain. People in Pecos County are now required to wear a face mask while out in public. The state of Texas informed the county on July 17 of the change, despite the county still being under the exemption level of 20 active case set by Governor Greg Abbott's executive order GA-29. As it turned out, the county topped 20 active cases by July 21st and sits at 20 active cases as of the afternoon of July 22nd. The governor's mask requirement allows law enforcement to issue a warning on the first violation and up to a $250 fine for each additional violation. No one can be arrested for not wearing a mask. According to Pecos County Judge Joe Schuster, people are now required to wear a mask covering their nose and mouth when they are in a group, be it indoors or outdoors, and when entering a business or public building. Common sense goes a long ways in this deal, he said. I use that definition of common sense knowing that it is not the same to some people as it is to others. People do not have to wear a mask while exercising outdoors unless they are with a group, when driving, or when at home, unless around people who don't live at the house. You need to wear a mask when you are around a group of people where you can't social distance, Schuster said. You should wear a mask inside and outside when you are around other people. Schuster said that it is fine to walk through a parking lot without a mask on as long as you are not among a group of people and are able to social distance. Pecos County is able to continue under Phase 3 capacity levels of 75% occupancy for businesses. If the county sees more than 45 active cases or 5 consecutive positive tests without a negative test, it would have to roll back to 25% occupancy under current orders. As of the afternoon of July 22nd, Pecos County had 20 active COVID-19 cases. Another 3 cases that tested positive in Pecos County but were assigned to another county also remain active. In all, 1,440 tests have been given, with 1,122 negative results, 184 tests pending, 104 positive tests for county residents, 40 positive tests for out-of-county residents, 1 death, 83 recoveries in-county, and 37 recoveries from out-of-county. Among the new local cases this week is a 72-year-old male with unknown contraction who is being hospitalized in an isolation unit at Pecos County Memorial Hospital. The man, who was tested July 7 at PCMH and listed as case number 102, is the first local confirmed case to be hospitalized in the county. Previously, 2 Pecos County women, ages 78 and 80, were hospitalized at Odessa Regional Hospital. Both have recovered. A 43-year-old man was hospitalized at Lubbock Covenant Hospital and has been released to self-quarantine at home. A 78-year-old Pecos County man who tested positive in El Paso remains hospitalized there. Caution. The basics are the best. Wear a mask, wash your hands frequently, and if in doubt, wash again and keep your distance from others, said Lynn Howard of Cactus Health Services. If you feel you must have that party, gathering, celebration, or close-up and personal relationships with many different individuals, do so with the knowledge that you are putting yourself at risk as well as risking the health of others. Howard said that some people who tested positive but did not require hospitalization still went through a period of feeling bad and took time to completely recover from the virus. She also pointed out that it has not been proven that someone who has had the virus now has immunity from catching it again, nor are they immune from spreading the virus to others. Too much is still unknown about this virus, and although many do recover fully without hospitalization, there are many that have not recovered at all, Howard said. Howard encouraged people to wear a mask around other people and to social distance. If you feel you must have that party, gathering, celebration, or close-up and personal relationships with many different individuals, do so with the knowledge that you are putting yourself at risk as well as risking the health of others, she said. Solar Farm Project Secures Financing. A large-scale solar farm project in Pecos County moved a step closer to breaking ground as Canadian Solar Incorporated announced July 21st that it had closed $282 million in debt financing to construct its Maplewood and Maplewood 2 projects. The two projects will be located east of Fort Stockton, according to Remy Ramos, the director of the Fort Stockton Economic Development Corporation. We have been working on this project since I started this position back in 2017, Ramos said. This large solar project continues to diversify our economy by employing people in the renewable sector. Maplewood falls in the tax entities of Pecos County, Ira and Sheffield ISD, and the Ira and General Hospital District. This project will bring much-needed jobs to the region while also generating tax revenue and utilizing local contractors and services, Ramos said. Canadian Solar Incorporated is the parent company of Recurrent Energy, LLC, under which the Maplewood projects will operate. Ramos said that Pecos County is home to 13 solar projects on 9 different sites. Research has shown Pecos County to be the second best location for solar projects in the U.S., given its days of sunshine each year. While Presidio County is first, Pecos County has the added benefit of extensive infrastructure for power transmission due to previous projects tied to the oil and gas industry. The Maplewood Solar Project has a capacity of 327 megawatt peak and already has a contract in place to provide power to Anheuser-Busch. The 40-megawatt peak Maplewood 2 solar project has a contract in place for delivery to Dallas-based Energy Transfer Partners. 2020 Miss Fort Stockton Pageant. Salmon Captures Crown by Steve Fountain. About the only struggle Kathleen Nicole Salmon seemed to have was getting her sash on correctly after being selected 2020 Miss Fort Stockton on July 18. She initially placed it descending from her left shoulder, which left the word Miss Fort Stockton upside down. She quickly made the adjustment and all was back to perfect. It was about the only hiccup in an otherwise solid pageant performance for the 2020 graduate from Fort Stockton High School. The pageant was held at the Comanche Springs Pool. With the water carnival and reunion weekend festivities canceled amid the COVID-19 pandemic, the pageant was the lone event to be held. About 100 people were allowed into the complex through reserved seating. The pageant was live-streamed by the Pioneer on its Facebook page and has been viewed more than 9,000 times. While the temperature was in the low 90s when the pageant started at 7:45 p.m., a cooling breeze kept things comfortable poolside. Reaction: surreal. It feels surreal, she said. I still can't believe it. I can't believe it is over already, in the blink of an eye. Of course, as a member of the class of 2020, it seems everything was over in the blink of an eye. Her senior year, including the track season, ended in March amid the COVID-19 pandemic closings. It was more like a waiting game for a long time, she said, because we tried to get back to normal multiple times and it just knocked us back down. I feel like if we keep going on and encourage each other, trust the CDC, and continue to pray, our country will get back to where it used to be. Salmon competed in last year's pageant, finishing as first runner-up. That experience helped her greatly this year, she said. It helped prepare me, not only mentally, but physically as well, Salmon said. I would have been super nervous. Last year, I was so nervous that I think I really stressed myself out, and that helped me to prepare to try not to be what you think Miss Fort Stockton should be, but to just be myself. That preparation included asking friends and her mother, DeAndrea Salmon, to pepper her with questions at random times so that she would be ready for the random question portion of the pageant. How random were the times? I asked my mom at 2 a.m. to ask me a question, Salmon said. Alyssa Faith Allaire was first runner-up in Miss Congeniality, while Julissa Isela Talavera Duarte was second runner-up and Miss Photogenic. Miss Junior. Aria Rojas won the Miss Junior Miss Fort Stockton pageant. Alyssa Rangel was first runner-up, and Alessandra Sanchez was second runner-up. The Miss Junior pageant was held in an abbreviated form with only the swimsuit portion held live on pageant night. The other pageants for younger participants were all canceled this year to help the event stay under the attendance restrictions ordered by Governor Greg Abbott. Do something. Your guide to local places to go and things to do. If you have an event for our Do Something listing, please email to steve.fountain@fortstocktonpioneer.com. Friday, July 31st, live at Zero Stone Concert Series, 7-Year Drought, 7 p.m. free, Friday through Tuesday, August 7 through 11. The Miracle Worker, stage performance by the Fort Stockton Community Theater at the new Nelson Street Theater, 102 South Nelson Street. For more information, call 432-336-3180. Friday, August 14, live at Zero Stone Concert Series, 2 Country for Nashville, 7 p.m., free. Friday through Saturday, September 11 and 12, Richard Reeves Memorial Cook-Off, the IBCA-sanctioned event, will be held at Rooney Park and benefits the Reeves Memorial Fund. Call 432-290-0124 for more information. Saturday, September 11 through 15, Ragweed Joe Melodrama Stage Performance by the Fort Stockton Community Theater at the new Nelson Street Theater, 102 South Nelson Street. For more information, call 432-336-3180. Friday through Saturday, October 2nd and 3rd, the Big Bend Open Road Race, the annual race to Sanderson and back on Highway 285, Friday through Saturday, October 30th and 31st. Horsehead Crossing Celebration, the Pecos County Historical Commission will commemorate the various historical figures who passed over this well-known crossing throughout the 16th through 19th centuries, including the Comanche War Trail, the Emigrant Trail, the Butterfield Overland Stage, and the Goodnight Loving Trail, made famous by Larry McMurtry's Lonesome Dove. COVID-19 proves a bum steer to inaugural rodeo. The 2020 Comanche Springs Rodeo has been canceled due to the COVID-19 pandemic, the Fort Stockton Chamber of Commerce announced this week. The inaugural event in 2019 was held at the Pecos County Coliseum. It had strong attendance and drew praise from participants. This year's event was set for August 27 through 29. Following increased concerns about the COVID-19 virus, we felt this was the best way to proceed during such an unprecedented situation, read the Chamber's press release. We are very disappointed that we cannot hold this year's rodeo, but we know it's the right decision based on the information we have today. We know that this will come as an enormous disappointment to the community and the participants who were planning their visits to Fort Stockton. The Chamber cited the uncertainty around state-imposed limitations on event attendance. Those restrictions included how many spectators could be in attendance, required safety precautions, and, in the end, if the event could be held at all. The Chamber said it wanted to avoid a last-minute cancellation. Our primary concern is the responsibility we feel towards the health and safety of our community, read the Chamber's press release. The well-being of our volunteers, partners, participants, and event attendees is critical. The number of out-of-town participants and attendees to this event is very high, and we want to help ensure that we all stay safe. The Chamber announced that sponsors may roll their current sponsorship over to the 2021 rodeo or receive a refund by contacting the Chamber.
Hello, I'm Jesse. I'm reading from the Monahans News for Thursday, July 23rd. School to start Wednesday, August 19th. The story was written by Paul Cyphers. School will begin on August 19th, Monahans Wicked Pyote ISD School Superintendent Chad Smith told the Board of Trustees in Monday night's meeting. With the evolving and frequent changes with dealing with the COVID-19 pandemic, quote, nothing is set in stone and could change, but that is the plan for now, Smith said. The start of school will be a soft opening, Smith said. The details of the soft opening are still being developed, and final details will be communicated before the start of school. Students will have the option of attending classes remotely or face-to-face instruction. There are no plans to offer a hybrid combination of face-to-face and remote instruction. Students must choose one or the other. Attendance will be checked every day, as has been in the past. Teachers will be able to see when remote students are online to be able to capture attendance. Students who cannot log in remotely during the normal day must do so in the evenings if equipment is not available during the day. Teachers can then check the timestamp of when students log in to record attendance. Teachers will be available every day from 8 a.m. until 4 p.m. Quote, remote students who wish to participate in UIL athletic or academic events will be allowed to do so. We can't penalize a student if it is the parents who decide for their child to work remotely. However, those activities must be attended in person, and same adherence to grades and attendance will remain in place, Smith said. Architect R.J. Lopez with Park Hill Smith and Cooper updated the trustees on construction progress in the district. Quote, renovations to Walker Junior High will be complete by July 31st. Demolition work has started at the high school, Cullender Kindergarten, and Tatum Elementary. The demolition work will be completed by the end of the year. Quote, because Victor Street has to be moved to the west by 50 feet, and that 12th Street does not go through yet, construction work on the new elementary school will not be complete until August 2022 instead of January 2022. It would be a push to complete by January, so moving to August gives us more time to make sure everything, including last-minute touch-ups, to be completed by the August date. Plans have been submitted to the city, so we should be ready to go soon, Lopez said. Changes to the student handbooks and student code of conduct for district campuses was approved. Highlights of the changes, as presented by Smith, were changes to the bullying policy to include cyberbullying and adding a comprehensive list of actions that would be considered bullying. Changes to the weighting of dual credit courses and honors courses. Students who fail a dual credit class will be suspended the following semester from taking any dual credit classes. Students may resume with the dual credit classes once the suspension has been lifted. Garments originally purchased with holes or frayed edges will be allowed. However, leggings must be worn under the pants, slacks, or jeans to prevent the viewing of skin. All students will take the fall semester exams regardless of absences. Students will be eligible for fall semester exemptions once they have met mastery of required state assessments. As a precaution, and to help alleviate the spread of pandemic viruses such as COVID-19, MPWISD may require students and employed staff, as well as visitors, to wear face masks over the nose and mouth, or full shields to protect eyes, nose, and mouth. If it is deemed necessary to enforce the wearing of masks by the MWPISD administration, written notifications will be provided to all affected individuals. The monthly financial and disbursements report, as presented by business manager Sarah Harris, was approved. As of June 30th, collections are 97.9% of the taxes due for both the maintenance and operations and the interest and sinking for the bond funds. Quote, "Our budget is based on 98% collection rate, so we are right on target," Harris said. Second Ward County Death reported. The story was written by Paul Cyphers. The second death in Ward County attributed to the COVID-19 virus was reported on Tuesday. The man was an 84-year-old resident of Barstow. The case had originally been listed as a Reeves County case, but it has been determined that they did live in Barstow, Ward County Judge Greg Holly reported. The patient was admitted to the hospital in Pecos on July 10th and transferred to UMC Lubbock the same day. According to what had been reported to Holly, the man had significant underlying health issues. He passed away on Tuesday. As of Tuesday afternoon, Ward County had 21 active cases, 69 total cases, with 46 recovered and 2 deaths. A total of 635 tests have been administered locally, with 12 pending as of Wednesday morning. The cases of the COVID-19 virus continue to increase throughout Texas and the nation, as well as the local area. As of Tuesday, Ector County had 2,403 total cases, 98 new positive cases reported Monday, with 1,028 active cases, 33 deaths, and 1,342 recoveries. Midland County had 1,604 confirmed cases, 82 new positive cases reported on Tuesday, 29 deaths, and 630 have recovered. Reeves County has reported 107 cases, with 63 recovered and 2 deaths. Pecos County has 80 confirmed cases, with 60 recoveries and 1 death. Andrews County has reported 198 confirmed cases, with 4 deaths and 83 recovered. Winkler County has reported 47 cases, but no information was available for the number recovered or deaths. Across the state, 356,000 cases have been confirmed, with 4,319 deaths. The total number of recovered was not available. Nationwide, 3.97 million cases have been confirmed, with 144,000 deaths and 1.1 million recovered. Type 1 diabetic teen starts nonprofit. The story was written by J.L. Smith, special to the news. Diabetes. The world is all too often the punchline to jokes about decadent desserts and obesity. Despite being one of the most common chronic diseases in the world, the diabetes umbrella is all too often misunderstood. Monahans High School junior Josiah Ray has recently established Endocrine Credible, a nonprofit organization, or NPO, to educate the public and change the way we talk about this condition. In 2013, Josiah was diagnosed with type 1 diabetes. He learned that his pancreas would soon stop working and that he would have to inject himself with insulin for the rest of his life. He was 9 years old. Today, Josiah is 16 and has learned a lot, not only about the autoimmune disease that affects him, but also about other types that fall under the diabetes umbrella. Quote, "Diabetes can be categorized into 5 types, all with different causes," reads the NPO website, endocrinecredible.org. The word endocrinecredible is a mixture of the words endocrine and incredible. The endocrine system is the body's chemical message system. Malfunctions of the system are the cause for multiple disorders, including diabetes. Quote, "It's an idea I've had for a while now, but I started to take it more seriously when I had a friend who got diabetes. People's first reaction was to blame his weight and his eating habits. Even he himself believed that. He didn't know that the different types of diabetes are treated very differently, and you risk mistreating it or not taking it seriously because you don't know the difference. People often see diabetes as just one disease, and that can be harmful, even dangerous," Josiah said. The mission of Endocrine Credible is to educate young people, specifically students, who can carry their knowledge of diabetes to their current households, as well as the people and situations they encounter in the future. Quote, "Someday, members of my board and I would like to give in-person presentations to schools across the country. But current COVID climate is not allowing that. But that doesn't mean we can't get the resources out there," he said. Quote, "By September, we plan to start shipping out presentation packages to students who can teach their friends, and those friends can teach their friends. It might even be more effective coming from a close friend than from some kid who comes to their school," he added. Ray's mother, Jessica, has been witness to his hard work for weeks. Quote, "Leave it to Josiah to do something powerful during quarantine. I watched him do lots of research and file lots of paperwork. He was eager for the mail every day, and when I saw that letter from the state of Texas, we knew it was official," she said. "Not only from living with type 1 diabetes, but also being a good student and citizen, I knew he could pull this off," she added. Follow Endocrine Credible on Instagram and Facebook to stay informed. You may also learn more or make a donation on the website, endocrinecredible.org. Gallegos sentenced for probation violations, murder charge still pending. The story was written by Rosie Flores. A Pecos man charged with murder was sentenced on an unrelated offense in federal court Monday morning by U.S. District Judge David Counts. A warrant had been issued for Arturo Gallegos Ortiz, age 45, of Pecos, for violating the terms of his supervised release from federal custody in conjunction with murder charges filed last year. Gallegos, who had been on supervised release for a federal offense that occurred in 2006, was sentenced to 5 years in federal prison by Counts, who is U.S. District Judge for the Western District of Texas at the Lucius Bunton Courthouse in Pecos. According to the warrant, Gallegos violated the terms of his supervised release after the Pecos Police Department charged him with the murder of two individuals in Pecos on October 24, 2019. On that day, Pecos police officers were dispatched to a home at 815 South Mesquite Street shortly after 8 p.m., where they said a person who arrived at the house reportedly had discovered two bodies. They were identified as Isabel Christian Hernandez, age 44, who lived at the home, and a male victim, Reynaldo Ramirez, age 79, of Austin. Pecos Police Chief Lisa Tarango said that at the time, officers considered Gallegos a suspect in the case, but were unable to locate him in the Pecos area. Police speculated Gallegos might try to flee to Mexico while also having ties to the Midland-Odessa and Lubbock areas. His vehicle was found at the Mesquite Street residence when officers arrived, and Tarango said 4 days after the murders that there were no other suspects in the case. On April 29, 2020, Gallegos was taken into custody by U.S. Marshals Service in El Paso after being arrested by Mexican police in Juarez. He was then returned to Pecos from the U.S. Marshals Service detention facility in Sierra Blanca. A bond hearing was held for Gallegos a few weeks later, and Tarango said that Gallegos was being held by the Marshals Service on a federal probation violation charge after serving a 10-year sentence for possession of marijuana. Police, along with Texas Rangers, Reeves County Sheriff's Office, and the U.S. Marshals Service Lone Star Fugitive Task Force were involved in the search, and on April 30th, the newspaper El Diario del El Paso announced Gallegos was detained by law enforcement authorities. He had been living in a house located in a Juarez neighborhood, where officials found him and transported him to the Isleta Port of Entry in El Paso. Police say that Gallegos, who was identified by the Marshals Service and then processed by Customs and Protection officials without incident and turned over to the Marshals, who first took him to a detention facility in El Paso before he was transferred to Sierra Blanca and later to Pecos. This led to the revocation of his supervised release, and Judge Counts sentenced him to 5 years imprisonment, up to life supervised release after that, and payment of any unsatisfied monetary sanction previously imposed. MEDC approves $3.4 million budget. The story was written by Christy Sullivan. The Monahans Economic Development Corporation Board of Directors approved the 2020-2021 proposed operating budget during their regularly scheduled meeting on Monday. The budget includes a projected sales tax revenue of $900,000 for the new budget year, combined with a projected beginning balance of $1.9 million, $600,000 in unclassified income, and $2,000 in interest on deposits, leaving a total around $3.4 million in available funds, an estimated 23% decrease from the current budget. The Economic Development Corporation is funded only from sales tax revenue, in which they receive 25% of the amount the city receives in sales tax revenue each month, creating a steady source of income. The proposed budget expenditures total $199,600, and line items are included $16,000 for advertising and scholarships, $15,000 for engineering services, $10,000 for legal services, and $6,000 each for training, and $3,000 for travel. Also included with the expenditures is $140,000 for a professional service agreement, $55,000 for the MEDC's director's salary with room for a potential raise. Included in the professional service agreement is building and computer equipment, supplies, travel, vehicle, and travel and training, which will all be paid back to the city. Capital expense projects is projected at $2.3 million, which is down $500,000 from this year's approved budget, leaving a proposed ending balance just shy of $1 million. Quote, included in the project line item is a potential lift station for Block 25 and 26, which are along the I-20 access road west of the new PJ's Coffee. Both are big lots, and we've had lots of interest in both lots, so I would like to have them ready to go when someone is ready to purchase the lots, MEDC Director Ashley Adalto said.
Thank you for joining us for this week's edition of Far West Texas. This is the Recording Library of West Texas, enriching the lives of individuals with physical, visual, and learning disabilities since 1963. You can hear this program on Recording Library of West Texas Radio and on demand with your computer or favorite mobile device at recordinglibrary.org.